The title of my talk is The Challenges of Zoster Surveillance. I just want to mention that while we are not expecting local jurisdictions to be doing zoster surveillance, we'd certainly be delighted to hear from you if you were interested in it, but we still think that this information would be useful and of interest to you. So first of all, why zoster surveillance? Well, it's to monitor the impact of the zoster vaccine program, to identify any problems in the program, and to allow for refinements in it. The key elements that one would want to track would include zoster disease, the total burden, severity, the distribution of zoster by age and other subgroups, the vaccine effectiveness against key outcomes, and also including the duration of protection and the protection in different specified subgroups, for instance, diabetics or persons over 80. There's monitoring safety, including identifying risk groups for adverse events, and finally, vaccine uptake to inform actions to remove barriers, to identify gaps and disparities in age, race, and other subgroups, and to assess distribution of uptake in order to address biases when evaluating vaccine effectiveness. So let's talk about disease surveillance for zoster. To monitor before we get to that, there is another reason to monitor zoster surveillance, and that is to monitor the impacts of the varicella vaccine program. And why would that be? Well, there are a number of reasons. There are a number of potential impacts of the varicella vaccine program on zoster. First, there is the impact on persons who have had chickenpox in the past, and that would include most of us in this room. Exposure to persons who've had chickenpox who have latent VZV in their dorsal root ganglia, if they're exposed to VZV, it boosts their immunity, and there's evidence that it might prevent zoster from developing. If that's the case, then the varicella vaccine program, by reducing the incidence of chickenpox, it reduces VZV exposure, and it might allow for an increase in shingles rates in the population. The other potential impact would be in persons who've never had chickenpox, who are susceptible to it, and by preventing chickenpox, the varicella vaccine prevents establishment of latent wild-type VZV infection and might thereby reduce the risk of zoster in that population. Okay, so moving on to disease surveillance for zoster. There are a number of challenges to doing disease surveillance for zoster. First, notification is not practical and CSTE is not really pursuing it. First of all, zoster is not really an actionable disease. There's no immediate public health action one would need to take around it. And also, adult providers lack the experience with disease notification. Another barrier is zoster is generally diagnosed clinically without lab confirmation. Now, the clinical diagnosis is probably pretty accurate, but we don't have data on that. But more importantly, perhaps, it does away with that laboratory interface so that there's no mechanism for doing laboratory-based reporting, for instance, like might occur for other vaccine-preventable diseases, reporting to the health department directly. It also takes away that interface for allowing providers to be able to distinguish zoster that is caused by the wild-type virus versus zoster that's caused by the vaccine itself, i.e. distinguishing vaccine failure from adverse events. So you lose that ability without lab-based diagnostics. Another barrier is that age-specific rates of zoster appear to be changing over time, and we really don't understand that. But with the moving baseline, how can we track the impacts of the zoster vaccine program or the varicella vaccine program? Next, the outcome that the vaccine is trying to prevent is really pain. It's not just the rash. And how do we monitor pain in a surveillance system? Zoster itself is not a very good surrogate for pain, since it varies differently with age than the pain in the zoster vary differently with age, and since the vaccine seems to prevent pain more effectively than it prevents zoster itself, so it's not a perfect surrogate. Finally, most systems that I'm going to be describing in the coming slides would not be terribly timely, but as I mentioned earlier, timeliness may not be quite as important for zoster as it might be for some other diseases that are more actionable. So let's talk about some strategies for zoster surveillance. The first would be administrative and claims data, such as Medicare Part D, the VA, HMOs. These provide large catchments for surveillance and analyses, but there are many caveats. for using data for these kinds of data for disease surveillance and other types of surveillance. The generalizability of the denominator, case finding is limited just to those persons who are seeking health care. The other ones aren't captured by the system. The validity of the codes is an important question. Also, you lose the ability to kind of be flexible about variables. You're stuck with the variables that are in the data set, so they might not include things that are important to your program. And finally, can claims data really be used to track zoster pain? That would seem to be a real challenge. Another strategy would be population-based surveys like NHIS or the BRFSS and other. These would provide true population-based data with which you can learn more about that component of zoster that would not be picked up by claims data. But there are many caveats, including the accuracy of self-reports in a survey. And also, you need a huge sample size to track zoster in a survey mechanism because the incidence is only about 1% per year. Another mechanism would be active surveillance, and that could be through sentinel sites like the Varicella Active Surveillance Project, or through provider networks like, for instance, the Flu ILI Net Surveillance Program. The advantages of these would be that they're likely more valid than claims data. They can track pain, there's more flexibility regarding the variables, but there are caveats, including the generalizability of sentinel programs, the catchment size, and the resources and cost for setting up systems like that is really prohibitive. Finally, one can consider doing special studies based on any of these approaches. These might not provide timely data, but as I mentioned earlier, timeliness may not be quite as crucial for the reasons I mentioned earlier. Well, what about hospitalizations? I personally feel that hospitalizations really don't provide good data for tracking the zoster vaccine program. And the reason for that is only a small percentage of zoster cases are hospitalized. And of those cases, a large portion of them are the hospitalization is the zoster is incidental to the hospitalization. They're hospitalized for other reasons, and they're not the cause for hospitalization. And of those that are attributable to zoster, of those hospitalizations, a large portion are occurring in the immunosuppressed population, which is contraindicated from getting the vaccine. So it's not even a vaccine-preventable outcome. And finally, trends in zoster hospitalization are probably driven substantially by the prevalence of immunosuppression in the population at large, and most studies don't really have good data about that. So moving on to assessing effectiveness of the zoster vaccine. A lot of challenges there too, of course. First of all, the inputs to doing effectiveness studies would be assessing disease, which I just mentioned all the barriers there, the challenges there, and also assessing vaccine uptake, and I'll be talking about that in subsequent slides. So there are all those challenges. In addition, I just want to point out that there are really no good correlates of protection for this disease, so there's no, you can't just look at immunogenicity as a surrogate for protection. But most importantly, the observational studies for vaccine effectiveness are prone to confounding, as many of you realize, and studies of zoster vaccine are especially problematic, and that's because we know very little about what distinguishes who does and doesn't get zoster, who does and doesn't get vaccine for zoster, and who does and doesn't have an effective response to the vaccine. Without knowing all those risk factors, in observational studies of vaccine effectiveness, heterogeneity in the vaccinees can confound analyses and produce misleading results. And you know what? The target group for this population is all about heterogeneity. The physiologic and medical heterogeneity amongst the elderly targeted for this vaccine is as great as for any other cohort. So look at these two gentlemen. Are they at equal risk of zoster? Are they at equal likelihood of vaccination? Are they at equal protection following vaccination? Well, we don't know the answers to that. But if, for instance, the gentleman on the left is at a much greater risk of zoster, at a much greater risk of vaccination or likelihood of vaccination, and is much less likely to respond to the vaccine, that would be an important confounder, and it would make it seem like the vaccine is not really working that well. So what strategies do we have to deal with these issues? Well, the most important thing is for us to continue doing good epi, collecting information about the epidemiology of zoster, of the vaccine uptake, and of immunogenicity to understand these risk factors. And until we really have better data about these, all we can say is that the vaccine effectiveness studies, it has to be assumed that they're going to be potentially confounded. This is very analogous to what many of you might have followed, what's going on with flu vaccine effectiveness in the senior population. There's a controversy about that now, even decades into the influenza program, because of the confounding effects in the senior population. So moving on to safety surveillance. The herpes zoster vaccine is the first live vaccine targeted to seniors. Since the vaccine strain of VZV in zoster vaccine is latent and can reactivate in theory at any time, how do you assess which windows to assess safety outcomes? More importantly, how do you distinguish cause and coincidence in this population with high rates of medical events? You've got heart attacks and hip fractures and strokes and falls and new detections of chronic diseases like cancer or Alzheimer's disease. And which ones of these do we consider implausible? We don't know. We have to be, we really just don't know. Safety is also going to vary in this very mixed population that has so many comorbidities and multiple medications and frailty, which is another challenge. And then finally, adult providers aren't used to reporting to VAERS. Moving to vaccine uptake, surveillance for monitoring vaccine uptake. Surveillance for uptake has to be widespread and with large catchment in order to meet the many objectives that I've talked about earlier, i.e. to inform action to correct barriers to uptake, to identify gaps and disparities in uptake, and to know who's receiving the vaccine in order to be able to really interpret your vaccine effectiveness studies. And there's no routine and comprehensive national or state-level systems in place to monitor uptake of adult vaccines. So what strategies do we have for that? Well, we have BRFSS, we have NHIS, and at the state and national level. In addition, one can consider looking at Medicare Part D data and HMOs and other administrative data that provide vaccine uptake information. There's the state registries, and those might be a very fruitful source of vaccine uptake information for those programs where they're monitoring adult vaccines. And then there is, in a very limited way, there might be information on biologic surveillance from the manufacturer, i.e. doses distributed. But there are caveats for these approaches, which include representativeness and adequate timeliness. And with that, I'll finish, and I thank you for your attention.